Welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations Season 6. Now, before we begin, let's not forget that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Squepik people. And I would add that I believe that doing what we can to resolve the situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Today, we are delighted to welcome back to Food Conversations someone who has been on the program several times before, for the simple reason that she has a wealth of information about food and food systems, food security, and the goal that we all share, the establishment of food sovereignty. Andrea Gunner is an agricultural economist, a registered agrologist, and past president of the Institute of Agrology, a busy consultant on farm management practices, and the co-owner of Rosebank Farms, a pasture-based poultry farm with attached satellite farms coordinated by Andrea and her husband, Steve. Andrea, a warm welcome to Food Conversations.
Thank you, Warren. Thanks for having me.
As I was reading, I was thinking you probably know more about food in your pinky finger than I and most of our listeners know in their entire central nervous system. But that's just an aside. Now, I want to remind listeners that you, around the early to mid-1980s, watched and were involved in the process in which the local food system collapsed in British Columbia, as it had elsewhere. I remember the name Earl Butts, who was the United States Secretary of the Interior, and his focus on cheap food for everybody. And that was all. That was the whole story. Now, I think we could probably start, because it's a current issue of considerable importance, and that is the question of food costs. And you said something when we were talking before the show that is a wonderful line. It's a quotable line, and I hope all listeners will be able to use it at some point in their lives. And you said, too much month at the end of their money. People have, they run out of cash before the month comes to an end. Why don't you kind of just meditate a little on the genesis of that idea and what it symbolizes?
It's actually, I'm going to be fair here, I'm going to attribute that line to my husband, who...
Steve, if you're listening, you've been acknowledged.
in his role as a community organizer, he runs the recreation facility, the Armstrong Curling Club, has a number of members who are being healthy by being out and active and social, but... sometimes there is too much month at the end of their money. And because it's such a robust facility with a robust social connections there, people get a sense. They see each other regularly and they get a sense of when somebody is, you know, just a little bit behind. And it's a tremendous thing. As you know, throughout the Shuswap, we're full of small communities where people are connected. And food costs have really, really risen. As an agricultural economist, I see that on the other side, where the majority of Canadian farmers live below the poverty line. Yeah. And I think...
and have to work off site so often.
Yes.
Almost always.
Yes. So that is what I've dedicated my life to, is actually helping farmers be financially viable.
Yes. A huge challenge these days. Food prices are spiraling upwards. They're not over yet. And on the line, on the subject of food prices and farmers' viability as running their own business, what sort of percentage do ordinary consumers pay out of their monthly budget, roughly speaking, for food? Because it's a pretty good deal. It has been a pretty good deal for a very long time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. In North America, in general, over the last 30 years or so, people pay between 12 and 14% of their household income on food. When you contrast that to other countries in the world, including Northern Europe, people are paying closer to 25 to 30% of their budget goes to food.
So
yes.
Double.
They have other costs that are lower. For instance, their healthcare costs are they have healthcare that is
much
universal
more,
access.
Indeed, much more subsidized.
And much more subsidized, yes. Yeah. But the actual nutrition costs for a household are roughly double.
Just off the top, do you have any idea what percentage costs would be for countries in the South? Because we don't think about it very much, but in many parts of the world, food costs are a huge part of people's expenses.
And that goes along, if I think about South America, if I think about Southeast Asia, yes, food costs are closer to that third of their budget.
Yeah. It's a true challenge. And I guess we've had such a good time, you might say, over many years that the Earl Butts plan to have everybody get cheap food has worked out, but it's not necessarily good food. It's inexpensive. In terms of farmers, and I think we should talk a little about the contrast between the cost of food for consumers and the cost of production for farmers. The costs have risen and the earnings have risen, but they've risen in parallel. And so the gap between cost and earnings is very narrow, and it doesn't take much to drive a farm over the edge.
It's, you know, nothing is simple. When you look in BC, for instance, we have the most expensive farmland anywhere in the continent of North America. Our cost of land and the debt servicing on that capital cost, then you add the infrastructure costs, which are high for every farmer across North America, depending on, it really doesn't matter on their scale, it's scale appropriate. The larger farmers, for instance, if you look at the dairy farmers in this area, of which there are many, and they are a bastion of the agricultural community, their debts are in the millions for a relatively small farm.
Somebody so that would be in the millions for an individual farmer sometimes?
Yes, that's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why is land so expensive in BC? I know we have a lot of mountains and stuff.
We have a lot of mountains. We don't have a lot of arable land. Our agricultural land is something on the order of 1% of our total land base. And the parts that are really good agricultural land are the places where everybody wants to live. So the Fraser Valley, which is beautiful, it's glorious, the Okanagan Valley, the Thompson-Okanagan throughout.
The Peace River.
Peace River land is not as expensive as it is in the southern interior.
But of course, it is also the hub for fossil fuel extraction.
Yes, it is.
And having been there a couple of times looking into that, the number of people moving out of the area who are grain farmers in particular,
yes,
is quite high. It's really getting hard for, they can't sell their land.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So compared to areas where the land is more amenable to farming, obviously that is a problem for BC. And the Lower Mainland in particular, talking about the mouth of the Fraser, has seen a massive change. I can remember when I was a kid, we used to buy strawberries and other produce in Lulu Island. I don't know if Lulu Island is
nobody
is not
calls
there.
It that anymore. No. Only people who are over 60, probably.
You never heard that anybody in the show. Yes, but it was astonishing that people just paved over paradise, as Joni Mitchell said.
And Michael Kluckner, yes.
Yes, and a lot of people now.
Yes.
Imposed on this already fraught situation, there's also the massive changes that are being brought about by climate change, the heating up of the planet, and particularly the development of extreme weather events. And that's inducing a lot of changes. Why don't you talk about those changes? Because they're really significant.
It is so significant. I was listening on the way here. I was listening to CBC Radio. Matt Galloway is not on today, but Dalton McKinney was talking to a farmer in southern Alberta about farmers' mental health and how that is affected by the weather, how that is affected by the yield, how that is affected by their economic situation. And it's so, so true, because in a hotter, drier world with more erratic weather events, it's very hard to be prepared for every outcome. It's really, really difficult. And the result of that is, over the last 5 years or so, we have had more droughts, significantly more droughts and much more hotter weather just in the last 5 years as compared to over the last 20 years, for instance.
Absolutely. Even in the top 20 years, I heard that 18 of those years have been the hottest that have been on record. Or they keep on beating each other in terms of forming the record.
Unprecedented is the new...
Yeah, it's the new normal.
Yes.
Normal is not predictable. Once again, I mentioned to listeners that I'm speaking with Andrea Gunner, who's a well-known agricultural economist and management consultant for farmers. And you see it up front. You see it face to face. The erratic yields issue is connected to how you plant your crops and what crops you plant and how you protect them. That's a huge issue for farmers these days, is it not?
It is, absolutely. When you do the assessment of the current year, and I try and get my clients to do that on an ongoing basis because it's much easier to adapt if you're looking at your records on a weekly basis rather than looking at them at the end of the year when all is said and done. The challenge of that is the weather patterns, even when you follow some of these really great weather apps that are based on your farm situation, it still is an inexact science. And so preparing for another heat event, for instance, there are only so many things that you can do that you can implement within 24 hours. So you decide to harvest early, or if you were lucky enough to have irrigation water, you apply more water. But it all comes with a cost. And whether it's a financial cost or a labor cost or a staying awake at night or not staying awake at night, but actually being working at night because it's cooler temperatures then. And it's not unusual. I mean, grain farmers have always harvested at night because of the dew point, but it's not unusual for people to just shift their harvesting time so that they can get the appropriate temperatures. And that comes at a toll. It comes at a personal toll. It comes at a family toll. It comes at a community toll.
It is extraordinary that we now are not surprised when a major heat event is followed closely by a major flood event. And in fact, that's been happening recently. We had a very hot summer a couple of years ago, and then we had floods that knocked out all the north-south highways in the province, which is... There's a term called solastalgia. It means... It's a term developed by Glenn Albrecht, who's an Australian philosopher, environmentalist. And it means feeling homesick when you're at home. In other words, you don't have a home that feels like home anymore. It's an extraordinary situation. Many people have this image of farming these days still as being a collection of small family farms that are in a bucolic natural setting. And in fact, you see 53-foot trucks, trailers going down the highway with pictures of these farms on the side of the vehicle of the truck, and it's an illusion because most of them, or an increasing proportion, and a lot of them already have disappeared. They've been swallowed up by agribusiness operations that are fulfilling the dream that no longer applies anymore, and which is this cheap food at any cost, and it's led to our food supply being often packaged and processed before it arrives in our homes. And another of the quotes that you shared with me before the show was, two whole generations depending on the can opener, which I really like because it's a very apt description of what many people do. The food that they eat has already been altered from its natural state into either a processed mixture of ingredients, and some of the mixing process would be pretty horrifying if people could see what is actually going on. But it's also led to a loss of food skills. Why don't you talk about that? Because that's an important factor as well.
Yeah, it goes back to Earl Butts, actually. Again, this...
Earl, I hope you're listening up there.
Yeah, I think he passed a few years ago.
I'm sure he did.
I followed some journalists who interviewed him in the old folks' home, and he, at the time, and this would have been, probably 2015, he, at the time, was still really proud of of the changes that they'd made. But what we see in the retail grocery industry, and the retail grocery industry in North America is amazing for its efficiency, for getting palatable food to the entire population at whatever cost point they're able to be at. But the reality of that is efficiency has been valued over nutrition, over balanced health. And where we've lost the food skills is, you know, it came with the Betty Crocker era in the 1950s and 60s, where chemistry came to food and took the burden of the incredible amount of labor that mostly the women in the household were responsible for. And it took them out of that kitchen slavery and was so, so marvelous. And people embraced it. And that was the start of not actually having food skills in the household, because then that led to women saying, you know, I don't want to be a nursemaid and a housekeeper and a cook and a, you know, bottle washer and the chauffeur and everything else. I want to have a career too. I've got a brain. And so the whole emancipation of women was helped, aided and abetted by the Betty Crocker era, which was marvelous, but there are unintended consequences.
I remember seeing some of the ads from the 60s and 70s of women in a pictorial ad raving over a new toaster or oven or fridge. And of course, these kinds of things still go on, but they look even more bizarre now than they did then. and of course, the accompanying feature of that is that going from ingredients to a fully finished meal becomes something that isn't really on the program anymore. And that also is accompanied by a set of values that says manual skills and knowledge that is expressed through manual behavior is no longer, you know, it's no longer credited. It's one notch lower than academic or intellectual activity.
And hence the opportunity for companies who offer a meal plan. And the cost of that is actually, generally, you're paying for the convenience of it. It's quite expensive.
The TV dinner world,
except in the modern take of that. And so the challenge is that there are fewer and fewer people who can just open the door of their fridge and open the cupboards and make a meal from what is there, because they just don't have that knowledge. What they can do is, if there are no cans, if there are no frozen TV dinners, they order out. They use Skip the Dishes. They don't have, and all of that comes at a financial cost as well as a cost to our food system.
I'm not privy to any of the statistics around these sort of instant food delivered to your home businesses. Do they seem to be, have they reached a peak yet, or are they still expanding?
They are still expanding. It is definitely a sector of the market that is taking more market share.
All right, we'll both heave a sigh. You're, however, connected to some of the programs that are bringing back food skills. Why don't we talk about those to help us not feel depressed?
Yeah, no, because these are really exciting. These are the things that make me skip and dance and sing with joy, because children are still, at whatever age, still capable of much more wonder and awe than adults. And the idea that you can connect them with something that actually makes a difference in their outlook, in their attitude, in their brain functionality is really, really amazing. So there's a program that the Public Health Association of BC has developed and sponsored called Cook It, Try It, Like It, which is a program.
Cook It, Try It, Like It.
Cook It, Try It, Like It.
No punctuation.
I think there are commas after.
It's nice of you to say just straight on through.
I know. And the idea is it's targeted at sort of 10 to 12 year olds. And that age is, you know, their brains are developing at an incredible rate. And they are so open. They're recognizing their agency in a world that seems limitless. And so through that program, the children themselves learn about healthy eating, healthy food preparation, meal planning in a balanced way, and they gain food skills. So for children who have never handled a sharp knife, because in this day and age, we're very careful about safety.
Helicopter parents buzzing around.
A little bit, yes. they learn knife skills. Mm-hmm. They learn food preparation skills in terms of food safety. They learn about sugar. And the most important thing, and the thing that I really love about the program, is children who have not had fresh fruit or vegetables, and there are a lot of children who haven't because they don't like it, because it's foreign.
It's got spots on it.
Whatever the case is, they haven't had the support, the right situation to try that. And now they're trying it with their peers. And when I teach it, I teach them to take a very small bite, because whatever is on your tongue, if you don't like it, you can deal with it with dignity. And nobody wants to.
Sorry, everybody.
to lose their dignity in front of their peers. Mm-hmm. We all want to look like we are competent and capable people. And it's important that they learn about the parts of their tongue and they start really paying attention to it. And in my experience with a number of these courses that I've taught, the children become such huge fans. It changes their family's outlook on food and it brings joy into the whole thing of menu planning and preparation. And we were lucky when our children were very young that an older agrologist said to me, this is what we did when our children were your age 6 and up. Gave each of them the agency to plan and prepare a meal one night a week. And so each child took a turn. And I've told lots of clients about this. And my children are all amazing cooks. They took that interest in it with the support. Of course, we oohed and awed whatever was for dinner, whether it was hot dogs and ice cream or
chocolate pancakes
or something more exotic. And they did really gain sophistication in food skills. And I see that in the classes that I've taught. So not only is there Cook It, Try It, Like It, there are chefs in the classroom. There's this farm to school program. There are a number of initiatives through the culinary arts and nutrition dietitians world in BC.
Remind listeners once again that I'm talking with Andrea Gunner, an agricultural economist and a person who helps farmers do their job when they're struggling or when they're starting up. Andrea, the school system has so long been focused around, as I mentioned a bit earlier, kind of an academic approach to the world, that you read books, you memorize lists. And this, what you're talking about is actual hands-on stuff for fairly basic skills. I mean, when you talk about equipping people to live in the world, how to make food out of raw materials, if you like, various kinds of plant and animal sources, is about as basic a skill as it could possibly be. Do you find, for example, that, remember that there's been this sort of sex differentiation, the boys learned all the high, physics and chemistry and stuff like that. Do you find that there's boys in your classes?
Absolutely. Yeah. I would say the gender balance for the most part is 50-50 or close to that. The boys are as enthusiastic as the girls, possibly more so, because breaking out of those gender roles, and face it, boys are often huge consumers. Their growth rates dictate that they need a lot of protein, they need a lot of nutrients. And when you give them the chance to play with their food, they are very enthusiastic.
You've also been
play being controlled play.
Yes, control play. Not throwing it at the wall and seeing
sticks. No.
You've also been involved with aware of teaching nursing students. which is an interesting phenomenon because, as we both know, my profession doesn't learn anything about nutrition in medical training programs, which I think is a sorry indictment of how medical training is structured. But nursing students, what sort of things are you have me passed on to them?
So what I did was I mentored nursing students in having them teach cooking in the school system. And the nursing students were all third year nursing students. So this is with the UBCO campus in Kelowna, and did not have a background. I think really benefited from learning the healthy eating lessons that the program was teaching.
And do nurses get any training in nutrition that you could tell?
I think they had I ended up giving them assignments.
Pretty rudimentary.
Yes, pretty rudimentary.
When you were teaching these skills, they're obviously pragmatic skills. They're skills that you can use not just as part of your professional work, but also as part of your personal life. Did you sense that there was that carryover taking place?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been lucky enough to have some contact with some of them subsequently to working with them in the schools. And yeah, I think without a doubt, all of them have said, you know, that was so valuable because I've been able to apply these lessons, the things that we were teaching the 10, 11 and 12-year-olds. I've been able to use these in my own home.
You know, you wonder what an education system is doing, what its function is. I think it's always conceived as preparing people for life after your education process is terminated. And here we're talking about something that couldn't be more germane to survival and profoundly valuable. And yet it's all sort of new stuff. It's not something that was there. I remember when I was in school, food science was not considered. I think a lot of it has to do also that we can measure stuff better. We were measuring biological processes as opposed to just inorganic chemistry and that kind of stuff. Let's go back to talking about money and survival, sustainability, economic sustainability for a bit. It's quite clear that, well, there's a fair amount of evidence that small farming, diverse crop productions and companion planting, all this kind of stuff, is actually more efficient and in some ways more, it brings more to communities for sure than farming that is based on long food mile transits and the kind of established pattern that's been in place for about the last 30 or 40 years. Why don't you talk about economic multipliers?
Yeah, so for those people who aren't familiar with the term of economic multipliers, it means that for every dollar spent on a product, there is an economic benefit to the community. For instance, if you buy a dollar's worth of goods from a local producer, and that could be, you know, any kind of a producer, that producer who lives in the community is going to spend that dollar at another business within the community, and so on. Whether they go out to see a movie, whether they, you know, hire a plumber to do some maintenance, that money tends to stay and roll around in the community. And for small farms, the multiplier effect is, you know, there's been lots of studies about it. It's quite a range. But in general, the most recent research that I've seen is out of Ontario from a couple of years ago. And the multiplier effect for small farms was 1.4 to 2.6. So that doesn't sound like very much of a range. But if you think about getting a 40% return on your investments, I don't know who in the audience might be getting those on a regular basis, but I can tell you that my investment portfolio
is not doing quite that.
It's not doing anywhere near that. So a 40% return to 2.5% is actually significant. When you contrast that dollar spent on, for instance, produce that has come from another country, The money goes to the distributor, to the trucking company, to the wholesaler, and finally back to probably an aggregate of farms somewhere else, whether that be in California or Mexico. So the amount of money that stays in the community to roll around and reverberate is relatively small, certainly well less than that dollar that you spent on onions or whatever the product. And so there are valuable reasons to spend your money on some local food, at the same time recognizing that we have some of the highest cost production. Not everybody is in a position to do that. But one thing that people don't seem to know is surprises audiences every time I give a presentation and talk about the slavery in this year, in 2023, production of agriculture. There is slavery throughout the world. And it isn't recognized as slavery in mass media, but it is exactly what it is. When there are illegal migrants coming into countries, working for free for 2 or 3 months on a plantation, and then lo and behold, the border officials arrive the night before the end of the crop when they're about to be paid. And they are taken in the middle of the night and put on a bus and shipped back to their home country. That food production system has just had free labor for the length of the harvest period. And it happens.
And it happens on this continent.
And it happens on this continent.
Would you say it is as prevalent in Canada as the States?
It is not as prevalent in Canada as the States, but it still does exist.
Still happens.
Yes.
When governments see this, do you see them acknowledging that this is slavery and putting in policies that are at least directed at trying to prevent it?
No. I see social justice activists in the food system who are aware of it and try so far with very small amount of success to bring attention to it. But the food system is very, very powerful, and they have very effective lobbying. Some of the most effective lobbyers in government are from food corporations. And I've seen this in both Ottawa and Washington. It's hard to believe, but I have been in the room with, you can see the dynamic between the legislators and the lobbyists, and they are,
they're working together.
Very linked. They are definitely very well working together.
The health sector is notorious for having revolving doors, and so is the pesticide part of the agricultural world. Their regulators are often former employers or former lawyers working for industry, and they go into the legislative realm, help to create laws that have loopholes scattered throughout them, and then they go back and work for the industry again.
It's called regulatory capture.
It is indeed.
And
wonderful.
It's a brilliant concept for those who are part of it.
Yeah, it's something that is as much a kind of a cancer in the middle of these processes as any sort of the old-fashioned kind of corruption where people take paybacks just for their own personal wealth. This is actually shaping the system. And shaping the policy framework.
And shaping the system for the benefit of the players, not for the benefit of the mass population.
Indeed, indeed. The Salmon Arm farmers market has been analyzed and shown, getting back to the multiplier effect, has been shown to be very effective as a sort of economic multiplier. But there's this shadow hanging over everybody, and that's the cost of land and the disposition of land. Land that is owned, say, by a farmer who is, he or she or the family is aging, their ability to farm fully is fading, but they don't want it to turn into a bunch of high-rises like all those properties down in Richmond where rich alluvial soil is buried under tarmac in large swaths of the land. That process has been a problematic one for a long time. What's the state of the affairs in this area now?
Well, we still have huge support amongst the population in BC for the agriculture land reserve. I know that for farmers, it's often a double-edged sword, because when that legislation was brought in, it was brought in with support for farmers in terms of research and extension and help with some of their capital costs. Those have all been whittled away over the years, so there's only the land reserve left. The population definitely here is aging. Are there farmers who are making their land available at low lease rates? Absolutely, there are. Is there enough of that? The challenge with that is often the lease terms are not long enough. So for somebody who wants to establish a business, a land-based business in agriculture, they're going to make significant infrastructure investments. And if those infrastructure investments are tied to the land, but they don't own the land, it becomes problematic.
They're in jeopardy.
They are in jeopardy. And land changes hands, families, you know, take a different course of action or direction. And so it is a significant deterrent to those people who have leased land and want to continue to farm, want to continue to be producers, have gained their skills, have got some momentum going, and yet cannot afford the $100,000 an acre price tag that comes for small plots of land. And it goes back to, we're on Indigenous land. That is not the way they managed it. The whole system of governance that we have, where we allowed, when I say we, that's we, the great unwashed.
The non-Indigenous society.
And British, going back to the industrial age in the 1700s, where the commons were taken apart so that people didn't have self-sufficiency and had to go and work in the factories, because with the industrial age, they needed factory workers. And so we monetized land, and it became a commodity.
Monetizing everything. I just remind listeners once again that I'm talking with Andrea Gunner, who is an agriculture economist and a registered agrologist, and at one time was the president of the Institute of Agrology here in BC. You touched on Indigenous approaches to land management, and just expand on that a little bit, because it's a theme that is very much part of what we talk about on this program, but also something that is emerging as kind of a rectifying influence on some of our extractionist kind of capitalist approaches to land management.
There are some really wonderful initiatives that individual members of the Indigenous community have embarked upon in the last few years. So one of them is Jacob Beaton of Tea Creek Farm. He has been working with, because one of the things that happened as a result of colonialism, as a result of the residential schools, is that the majority of the Indigenous population that is reserve-based lost their capacity for food production. They lost the knowledge, they lost the skills, they lost the motivation, and yet they've still got that land. And so people like Jacob and Julian Napoleon, who's on Amisk Farm up in northern BC, he's another one that is working to build the skills, train people, bring the desire for that kind of work, the benefit, the not only is there a social benefit, there's a connection with the land that's all Indigenous people will tell you the land is the most important thing. Yes. And so bringing those skills and the desire and the motivation back and doing some really great things here in the Thompson Okanagan. I know in the south, actually it's in the Similkameen, there's a farm that One of the band members has been working on this for the last 8 or 10 years and is starting to gain traction. The Okanagan Indian Band also has a community farm that they have embarked upon and are gaining traction, gaining momentum with it. So it's starting, but we've got that 2 generations of can openers to educate. So there are lots of them. And the nice thing about the Indigenous communities is the demographic is quite different. They have a lot of young people, and the young people can be, given the right circumstances, can be sponges, can be great educators and participants in this new revitalization of food systems, bringing in Indigenous practices into
now, there's it. There's another feature of Indigenous society and culture, and that is that unlike ours, which excludes people as they get old, Indigenous culture not only retains them as viable members of the community, but actually approaches them. Another quote was, "The elders speak last."
Yes.
And allowing elders, and especially elder women, the Rise Up Indigenous Wellness organization, we've interviewed its principals here a couple of times, and we're going to be doing it again. Their board has both the mothers of the two protagonists on the board. Now, I think in our culture, that would look like nepotism, but it isn't. It's the exact opposite. It's honoring and respecting the knowledge of past generations. Why don't you talk about that? Because I think that's a fertile
subject. It's a wonderful situation. And it's quite interesting because there are a few accounts of people coming over to the New World and recognizing that the governance system was very different, that it was a community-oriented governance system, that the community as a whole looked out for all members of the community, and that everybody had a voice at the table. And so the practice of having a community consultation where everybody has a voice. You speak about an issue, everybody has a voice on that issue, and those with the most perspective, the most history, the most experience are the ones who speak last. And that's very powerful. They get to hear what the younger members of the community, they get to hear those perspectives, and then they bring their analysis and their assessment and their history into tying it all together. And everybody gets to hear that after hearing. It's a very different model of governance than what we have. It's also one of those things for people who have ever seen that poster that says, if you want to go fast, go by yourself. If you want to go far, go together. And they, like when I think of other countries around the world that have a different governance system, China comes to mind. They play the long game. They're looking 7 generations out and looking at least that many generations back.
One of the keys to this long game is matriarchy. A matriarchal system, which doesn't make the biggest, strongest, most aggressive people heads of the community. It makes the older, wiser, the ones who can say, don't get away from our natures as human living creatures, include us and the landscape we live in as one unit.
And it's not just that, it's also the fact that the women are the caregivers and their motivation is to make sure if everybody's doing, you know, if some people are doing well, the point is to have everybody doing well, not have inequality in the community, which is going to foster unrest. It's going to it's the strongest thing that we have is a sense of justice. And if people are being treated unfairly, there's injustice. And do we ever see that in other areas of the world right now and over time? Injustice is a very strong motivator.
It's interesting that there's a very strong intersection between the health of the land and a healthy relationship with the land and human health. Of course, I'm very aware of that because I see people when they're not feeling healthy. But I also know what it's like when people are healthy and how valuable it is to feel healthy rather than to feel unwell. And we've gone through this transition within the healthcare sector of changing aging into chronic disease management. And nutrition is the key to making sure that that analogy dies on the vine, if I may use a phrase, that it stops happening. We can make health without the healthcare system by incorporating nutrition into the kind of process that we use.
And the earlier you do it, the better the benefit, unsurprisingly. It's true that in our customer base, if I think back to our customers, the percentage of new customers that we get because there is a health crisis, either within their own health or within somebody close to them in the family, and that is significant. People decide, oh, I've got to change the way I'm eating because of the chronic health issue.
And you know, it's funny because people think about it when they get sick.
Yes.
And that's way too late.
Yes.
As you pointed out just now, the time to start is when you're young. When I was a kid, Kool-Aid was the summer beverage of choice. And when I and my sister saw how much sugar was put in it, we were kind of astonished, but it was still the beverage of choice, so we consumed it. Let's talk a little more broadly now. The agribusiness world, and it's part of a broader sort of commercial pattern, has undergone a process which some people have characterized as Walmartization, because Walmart is an exponent on a grand scale. And it's a situation where you squeeze the producer tighter and tighter and tighter with his grip, this economic grip. Why don't you talk about about the harms of that approach? Another hour, please.
Oh my goodness, that is a big topic, Warren. Mm. The challenge of that. Okay, so first of all, there's a good thing about that. And the good thing is it forces farmers to look for efficiencies, to find the efficiencies. And we do need that. We need that in the food system. We need to manage our pest management systems better. We need to manage our nutrient profiles better. We need to ensure that we're not over applying a nutrient to the detriment of our waters and streams. And so having that efficiency and really knowing your numbers is such a benefit. On the other side of that.
In other words, what you're saying is modern science has a role to play. It just doesn't run the whole show. It's something. It's an ingredient in the.
It is an ingredient because there are more ways of collecting data. The challenge with that is there is a lot of just labor involved. And if you have to spend a certain amount of your day analyzing data and still get the labor done, it means that it's harder and harder for a small farmer, an individual farmer who only has, you know, family labor or maybe one or two hired members of labor, to be all things to all people, to do a good job. And so that's where refining what you're actually making money on and coming up with a balanced operation that gives you the flexibility to change when circumstances like weather or markets change, but also have the resources to be able to take a holiday away from the farm, to reflect and to have the mental energy to do that. And it's a tightrope. It is definitely a tightrope. Even without the Walmartization, farming is a tough enough choice that when you add in those pressures of, I have to be bigger in order to get the supply contract, and so in order to be bigger, I'm going to lose this part of the business that looks to be a game changer for me, profitability, because I need to do the debt servicing this month, the next month, and the following month.
Is this not a natural a process that leads naturally to cooperative behavior among farmers?
Yes.
You gave me the segue and I picked
up on it. And in other parts of the world, in other parts of Canada, that is exactly what happens.
And in our own history, all those elevators in the prairies.
All the elevators in the prairies. BC is different. If you look at, so the one that I like to compare BC to, because they've got the same number of farms and kind of the same number of farms and the same mix of farms as Quebec. Quebec has got roughly 25,000 farms. BC has roughly 25,000 farms. In BC, about 20,000 of those farms make less than $100,000 a year. Probably more like less than $50,000 a year. So they're small farms.
Is that net or is that absolute?
That would be gross.
Okay, gross. So they make $100,000 and they spend... Oh, 95,000.
Yeah. Well, at least 50,000.
Yeah.
Probably more. In Quebec, same 25,000 farms, 20,000 of them are smaller, but more than 100,000. They have a better return on investment, and they have a wide, well-developed network of cooperatives. In BC, why don't we have cooperatives? Well, we've had cooperatives. BC Tree Fruit Growers is a cooperative. The marketing boards deal with cooperatives. United Grain Growers, which is in Alberta but also in BC, is a cooperative. There are cooperatives. But by and large, of the 25,000 farmers that we have, or the 25,000 farms that we have in BC, a very small percentage of them are members of a functional cooperative. Why is that? It's partly, I believe, and I'm not an expert on this, I'm not a sociologist, but I believe that people went west to be independent, to make their own decisions. And BC is a province of mountains and very narrow, small valleys. People don't see each other.
They don't see each other, and they don't necessarily learn from each other.
So they don't necessarily learn from each other, and they don't necessarily know each other enough to trust each other. And so the idea, the sentiment is, well, I'm not going to share my secrets with you because you might take my good ideas and outcompete me in the market. Not recognizing that the market is much, much bigger than your own backyard. And so we've got this system of people not collaborating on the long term the way they do in other areas.
There's a little bit of this kind of commercial competition spirit that's arisen both here and in many other places. The co-op principle, I think, was more comfortably established 40 or 50 years ago, because maybe the societies that were developing were more homogeneous. They saw that they had shared interests. And now there's this kind of commercialization of food that makes it seem like you've got to have a better food, often packaged, often processed, than the next person, which is a real shame. We just have a couple of minutes, and I wanted to get back to something you mentioned earlier. You used the word justice, and I see justice as a basic principle in human, you know, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, is a pretty basic principle around the world. Why don't you talk a little about justice and equity as we're closing down?
Again, another big topic to try and do justice to it in 2 minutes that I'm allowed is but I'll give it a shot.
Give it a shot.
So justice is when people are treated equally, where you can see that in the market, in agriculture, where Canadian farmers are producing whatever their product line is, and they're competing in a world market. And so if I look at the grain industry, because we do a lot of export grain, Canada has the lowest rate of subsidies of any of the G7 countries. And yet we compete in that world market where there are not only monetary subsidies, but also government input into research and extension and support for technology transfer, that Canadian farmers can only dream about. And so our neighbors to the south have that. It's not equitable and it's not just, but it is the system that we have to operate with. So when I look at the Canadian farmers that I deal with, mostly across Western Canada, but I have friends and colleagues in the eastern part as well, they are smarter, they're better with their numbers, they are paying more attention to the trends than I would submit the majority of the American farmers are. Does that bring us to an equitable position? No, but it brings us closer. It does bring us closer. And for those who decide Canada's not for them and they head to the States, by all accounts, they do very well there.
Andrea, it's been a treat to have you back on the show. I think we could probably spend a whole show talking about equity and developing it and letting it infiltrate into what we do in this country with respect to food. But I think we've had a good start on it today. And thank you very much for being with us again.
Thanks. It's a pleasure. Thank you, Warren.